Hello, I'm Jonathan Mosen. On many of the blindness-related email lists, whenever there's a major problem that many people can't solve, George Bell seems to be able to. George Bell is the owner of the highly successful Technovision Systems in the UK. On the Blind Line of Saturday, the 6th of August, I spoke with George about his company and his view of the technology industry. We began by talking about how he got involved in all of this.
Well, I was working with another company, and sort of felt that I had an interest in specialising in this particular area. So we put together a bit of a business plan, and suddenly about 12 or 13 years ago, that was it. We were launched into Technovision Systems. And it just went from there, really.
The business plan must have been interesting because one wonders how easy it is to make money out of a very niche market thing like the blindness business.
It is. It's extremely tricky because you have a very small and very specialist market. And in fact, in theory, a marketplace for Braille products, for example, when you consider that RNIB statistics in the UK indicate that there are only somewhere between 25 and 30,000 Braille readers and Braille users, it is a remarkably small market, yes.
And I suppose also the degree to which you can succeed may depend on the degree to which government will assist with funding for equipment, since many blind people are on low incomes or social security. Do you have a very generous government with respect to equipping people to get work in the UK?
In a word, no. There is the Employment Service Aids to Work Scheme, and the object exercise of that is that a visually impaired person in employment can obtain equipment through the Employment Service scheme. And there have been various changes in that scheme recently, whereby now the employer has to possibly contribute 20% towards the cost of it. So if you start taking things like Braille printers and Braille lines, the employer is having to face a fairly significant contribution, and I think there's a little bit of resistance from some employers. But overall, in terms of equipment supply over here, the market was split up roughly, as far as our business is concerned, to about a third of the Employment Service, about a third education, about a third private. Well, the Employment Service side of our sales these days is less than 10%, with the remainder being split roughly 50-50 between private individuals and education, which then leads you to say, well, how come such a big private market? But there are quite a number of charities like Electronic Aids for the Blind, for example, who make it their business to help to raise funds for equipment for private individuals that can't afford it themselves.
How do you feel about that? Is there a danger in blind people being too dependent on charity for their essential needs? Do you think the government needs to play a more activist role in this area?
Well, they're certainly trying to spend more time or more effort in getting people back to work. But what's rather alarming, and I think this is a trend worldwide that will probably have me shot down in flames, but at least I'll get you a few phone calls, is that a lot of blind people actually don't want to go back to work. They're quite gainfully employed in voluntary work or playing around on the internet or whatever. And in fact, an employment officer in London actually told me that he had a register of something like 21, 22 people who had quietly taken him off to one side and said, look, you know, put me at the bottom of the list. I'm doing quite well on my own, thank you very much.
So is there a disincentive? Do we have social security systems around the world that act as a disincentive for blind people to pull their weight, do you think?
I can't speak for the rest of the world. I wouldn't say that the social security system in this country is generous by any manner of means. Tends to be a subsistence, livable situation. But I think there are a number of people who are quite gainfully, shall we say, black market employed in a sense, or grey market employed, who do a little bit of work for people producing Braille or otherwise. I wouldn't say it's a common thing, but certainly there is an element of that.
How did you go about selecting the products that TechnoVision System chooses to retail and to recommend?
Well, first of all, the primary thing that we had to consider was how much support do the products that we sell require. First of all, if you take something like a Braille printer, usually there is very little in terms of support on a product like that. However, there is a lot of support in the Braille translator that you supply. And it's in things like that that you have to decide, is the Braille translator you're going to supply, is it a good translator? Is it easy to support? Does it have problems? And of course, not least of all, is the margin there to provide that after-sales support? Because as far as we're concerned, the sale doesn't end when somebody's bought it. There's a relationship that goes on for many years afterwards, and we hope that in 5, 6, 7 years' time, when people want to replace that equipment, they'll come back to us and they'll say, well, I've always had good service from you, you've always helped me, now what do you suggest that I replace it with?
So how many staff do you have at the moment providing that support?
Well, there are 5 of us at the moment, including the Braille production side, which we have as well. We've got a fairly, in fact, I think it's true to say that we're Britain's largest commercial producer of Braille. That is to say that we produce Braille and charge for it and make a profit at it. And we do a lot of work for government departments who require leaflets and so on and so forth of, you know, social security leaflets or things to do with education and reading and various other things that are around at the moment that people have an interest in. With the rest of us, we have a full-time engineer who, obviously, we call him Mr. Fix-It, Kevin Sanderson. He's very much a what we call a board man. In other words, he's not a board swapper. He actually gets down to repair components on the board itself, which, by the very nature of our industry, things are quite expensive, and therefore, you know, you just don't just go along and change a motherboard in a Braille printer and expect it, you know, the customer to pay for it, because they are very expensive. So you tend to find yourself repairing them. And the rest of us, in terms of, you know, software support, things like Braille translators and screen reading software that we sell, do require a considerable amount of software support, and the rest of us are geared up to do that. If we can't help an individual customer, I've got no hesitation in picking up the phone and phoning Canada or America direct to the manufacturer and asking for his help.
So you've obviously had considerable success throughout the time that the business has been operating.
We've put it this way, we've survived this long, and it has been hard work. We try to do our best to provide support, and I think those are paying dividends now, that policy.
Let's come back to the Braille production side of things, because those of us outside of Britain obviously know about the Royal National Institute for the Blind, and many of us have read Braille from them. It must have been a bit tough to establish yourself as a profitable commercial entity in that area when you had such a monolith like the RNIB in the background.
In some senses, yes, but I think the approach that we took was that, fortunately, when we went into Braille production, we actually were selling a Braille software package that came from Australia that was extremely simple to use. And that was the forerunner, as far as we were concerned, to a number of packages which have appeared, not mentioning any names, but I think we're all familiar with the kind of PC packages for Braille that are available for, you know, $200 or $300, which allow us to simply take a regular PC, a text file, and produce extremely accurate Braille out of a Braille printer. And that is really all we did, except we were applying it in terms of larger numbers. So therefore, we were able to go out and buy a large printer that prints something in the region of 800 pages of Braille an hour. And when you actually do the serious costing on it, it is cost effective to produce, you know, 200 or 300 of something, where the RNIB are geared up, and in many respects, although it's changed a lot recently, but in many respects, their most economical production numbers started at sort of 1,500 copies of something. Now, we could do anything from 1 to 1,000, even 1,500, and our manufacturing costs or our production cost would be considerably less.
Did you perceive a market when you started that brow production, or have you had to do a bit of advocacy to actually grow the market and demonstrate the importance of braille?
I'll be quite honest with you, with the equipment that we decided to purchase, which wasn't an arm and a leg job, the method and the method that we were using to produce it, we were able to offer production in a very, very short turnaround in terms of time. We've often done, you know, literally 24-hour shifts over a two or three-day period to produce, you know, 1,000 copies of something a government department's wanted. Now, by the nature of the method of production used by other larger producers, they had to make zinc plates and various other bits and pieces. And if you find a mistake on a zinc plate, it's not an easy job to, you know, tap a couple of characters and correct it. And that method of production does take a long time. But having said that, once you've got a zinc plate production press up and running, 1,500 copies can go out in a you know, no time at all. But it might take 5 or 6 hours to set that press up.
One of the things that we're debating here in New Zealand is obviously the need to encourage more people to take up braille, and there's a feeling that sometimes the rehab professionals turn some of the older people off braille. Of course, they're the majority of blind people, and I wonder whether there might be a similarity between the state of braille at the moment and the state of, say, Welsh in Britain or the Maori language here in New Zealand, that unless it's given more prominence and made more relevant, then braille is in real danger of dying out, not because technology has replaced it, but simply because it's not been promoted appropriately.
I think you're absolutely right. There is a tendency for the, shall we say, the advisory professionals, if that's the right term, running scared of braille and not giving it the kind of importance that is required. I mean, my feeling about it is that, you know, when I was at school, I was taught to read and write with a pencil and paper. Now, if somebody has the ability to read braille in the first place, and not everybody can, you know, read braille, but assuming you've got a level playing field in the sense that you've got children who, you know, are capable of reading it, that those kids should be taught braille right from day one, from when they're, you know, capable of putting letters and words together. There are some very good products in the market now which will actually help teach children how to use and how to read braille that can be integrated in with the mainstream education. I mean, a classic one is the tactiles produced in America, which to all intents and purposes to a sighted person just look like Lego bricks. But these Lego bricks, the bits that stick up that interlock into one another, they have these with the braille characters on them. Now, kids can have fun, both sighted and blind kids together can have fun making up words and making puzzles for themselves, as well as, you know, building things. And in that way, you can encourage kids to learn braille. But I've seen far too many cases in the last 20-odd years where a sighted social worker or whatever simply says, oh, all you need is a pocket tape recorder.
Can you?
I think that's wrong.
Yes. Can you envisage a time where at some point in the future technology will totally replace braille?
No, I can't. I can't, in all honesty, because at the end of the day, let's face it, many people beside the telephone will have a list of popular telephone numbers. You know, the number for the local, you know, the local grocer, the local, you know, take home Indian food or whatever. They'll have lists of Christmas card lists of friends, which are written down in pieces of paper. So I can't see, you know, I can't see technology entirely taking over those kind of things. Labeling of food tins, you know, all manner of different things that people, you know, would use handwriting or some form of identification for. I think also another aspect that has been true in the past is that Braille and Braille equipment, Braille has been expensive to produce and Braille equipment has been expensive to buy. Well, nowadays, I mean, over here, we've got Braille printers that are selling at barely over £1,000, whereas 5 or 10 years ago, you wouldn't buy a Braille printer for less than £6,000 or £7,000. Now they're 3-4 times as fast and a tenth of the cost.
And how about Braille displays? Because we hear as a rule that in the US, there's not a big market for Braille displays and that people tend to use speech, and that in Europe, they're big Braille users. I know that Britain still sort of sees itself as kind of on the fringe of Europe, so what's the situation there?
Well, the situation is that in many European countries, Germany and Holland in particular, the insurance companies provide that sort of equipment, and cost is not a factor. Whereas in America and in Britain, the cost of such a device has to be justified. So therefore, the costs of that kind of equipment in America and in Britain and a number of other countries do tend to be lower, because the manufacturers simply cannot get away with the extremely high prices that they would charge an insurance company. Having said that, the insurance companies are beginning to waken up to what's going on, and certainly I know the Germans have done a great deal of research and investigation into the kind of price fixing that has been going on. But again, we're also seeing considerable reductions in the cost of Braille displays. We have one recently that's come in, which is a 40-cell display that we're going to be able to sell for hopefully under £3,000, whereas currently a 40-cell display is going to cost you between £4,000 and £5,000. So manufacturers themselves are becoming very conscious of this and are investigating ways of at least trying to make the equipment cheaper.
You will have seen some phenomenal change in the time that you've been involved in this business. I guess at the time that you started, the IBM PC business was just really starting to become the major way to go for access, and we were using DOS and things like SoftVert, and very different times.
Well, I remember the very first business PC that I bought. It had a single 5 1/4 inch floppy drive and 512K of memory, and I was doing all my letters and my accounting system on that. When I suddenly got one with a 20 megabyte drive, I thought Christmas had come. <laughs> 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 It was absolutely wonderful that I didn't have to go swapping stuff around. And in those days, yes, the Dolphin speech synthesizer were just about the only thing around. Vert, Frank Audio Data was beginning to appear on the scene, and technology was in its extremely early days. And I even remember going to an exhibition a couple of years after we'd started, where there was vague talk of this going to be a very, very cheap, good personal Braille embosser electronic that was going to sell for about £300. Well, that didn't quite happen. It was a little bit more than that by the time it came out. But, you know, that was the days of the early design of the Mountbatten Brailler.
When you read a lot of the email lists, as I know you do, you see comments from veterans of those days who make the comment that things are much harder now and that it's a lot more difficult with the graphical environment we have to deal with for blind people to learn PCs. Do you think it's got tougher?
I think we've got to get this whole thing into perspective. Yes, it's got tougher, but it's got tougher for sighted people as well. The complexity of software these days is quite vast. And when you start going into things like Office 2000, for example, Office 2000 Professional comes with two CDs, and it was only yesterday, excuse me, sorry about that, It was only yesterday that I discovered the second CD of the Office 2000 suite had something called Small Business Manager. Well, by the time I'd finished installing that, my Outlook 2000 had acquired a whole different bunch of new features, like I'd look up a contact, and in a box underneath were a whole bunch of email messages to and from that individual, which hadn't been there before, you know. So suddenly an enhancement had been added to my system that gave me, in my particular case, gave me additional facilities. So I didn't have to go hunting around for emails for particular individuals, provided I had them in my contacts folder. So, yes, things are becoming more complex. There's a more of a learning process involved, and once you have learned them, they're not so difficult to handle. But I can equally sympathize with somebody who's been a DOS user for so long, suddenly moving from something like WordPerfect 5.1, where everything's neatly laid out in 26 rows and 80 columns in the screen, in fixed positions, and then suddenly is confronted with a Windows version of the same thing, where it's, to all intents and purposes, WYSIWYG. So you actually see on the screen, you see what it's going to appear, or how it's going to appear, when it comes on paper. So trying to explain the concepts of things like proportional spacing in characters, where you don't just have 80 characters on a line or 65 on a line or whatever you've decided. You determine the width in inches or in millimeters of your document. You determine a font size, and there could be varying numbers of characters on a line. Now, just getting your head around that concept alone can be extremely difficult. You know, what's happened to my column number? Why are my column numbers not accurate? You know, I've tabbed or I've cursored along 10 characters and it tells me I'm in column 9 or something like that. You know, I can understand those difficulties.
You've raised a really interesting point there, because I guess it's important for people to separate their blindness-related difficulties from the way that they interact with the computer as an individual anyway.
And
one of the things that really interested me was that before we made the switch here at home from DOS to Windows, I was regularly assisting my wife in a major way with the computer, and I attributed that to the fact that it was a command line interface, and that when we switched to Windows, that whole relationship would change, and actually it hasn't. I mean, obviously, when we get stuck, I still have to ask what's on the screen, if the screen reader won't boot up or whatever, but it actually comes down to whether you as an individual, blind or sighted, find this stuff intuitive, and despite the graphical user interface, it surprises me still how many sighted people don't find this stuff intuitive.
That's absolutely right, and I think this is why it's very difficult for our particular industry to deal on the technical support side of things. When somebody calls you up and says, I'm having problems with my screen reader installing a printer. Now, you just take that sentence and analyze it. I'm having problems with my screen reader installing a printer. What they're actually, they may not know themselves at the time, is that the installation of the printer is a Windows problem. It is not a screen reader problem. And how do you separate the two? Because there are instances where we've had to, in the nicest possible way, say to somebody, look, this problem is not your screen reader. It's not our problem, so to speak. You need to contact the supplier of that particular piece of software and ask them and get onto their technical support desk. But of course, because we may have supplied the computer and the adaptive software as well as the application software, they quite understandably think that we should sort everything out. So you get questions on Internet Explorer and how you get logged into various sites and how you set up with a new ISP and so on and so forth, when in actual fact the ISP should be telling his client how to set up to access his internet connection.
And yet the trouble is that when you ring some of these help desks, for instance your ISP, and they go through a debugging process, all they will be able to tell you is to double click this icon, etc., and many of them don't know the keyboard equivalents, and I suppose that must be one of the frustrations that you face.
It is a problem that we face, and it's compounded by the fact that, A, we may not know the particular application that the user is trying to get at, never mind whether there are any keyboard combinations for that. But I think more and more these days, people are beginning to realize that the mouse is not the be-all and end-all. And in fact, I recall fairly recently seeing an item in a computer magazine where it was listing the top 100 red hot tips, I think they called it, for handling Windows. And the second item on the list was, do you realize that there are keyboard equivalents? So you can do Alt F instead of pointing at file and clicking on it. You can do Control S to save instead of pointing at file, clicking on save, etc. with the mouse. And I was absolutely, I just fell about laughing with that, and I actually copied the article and pasted it onto a number of, sent it to a number of the boards like Blaindell and GUISpeak and whatnot, and it was amazing the responses I'd got. You know, suddenly the sighted world has realized that there are actually keys on the keyboard.
And it's actually becoming more of an issue because of occupational overuse syndrome, where many trainers are now saying the mouse and overusing it is a health hazard, and they will now unplug it and teach the keyboard commands in programs like Office, for example.
This is true. Far more of this is going on, and I think it's through companies like ourselves, as well as individual users, who have to try and make software companies aware of the fact that their software should be fully keyboard controllable. Now, I remember a major music software producer over here, and they had come along to an event we held at Trinity College of Music in London, and I had said just precisely the same thing I say in many instances. I wish, as a final testing phase of software development, that the programmer had to run his program for 2 or 3 weeks without the mouse. And I was cross-examined by this marketing manager of this company, and believe it or not, 4 weeks later, the second page of their manual for their music program actually says, now put the mouse to one side and you will learn from here how to more efficiently control the software through the keyboard. And I thought that was wonderful. Now, had we not had that conversation, had that particular individual not come along to an event which was specifically aimed at music for visually impaired people, we would never have had that little bit of success. Similarly, with an American company, as I say, I'll avoid mentioning names here, but another very large American sequencing company, we've also had opportunity to speak to them on exactly the same thing, and saying, well, look, this is not just a blindness issue. This is an efficiency issue, that it is quicker, very often quicker, to use the keyboard than it is to use the mouse. The mouse is a lazy man's tool, as far as I'm concerned. I seldom use it these days.
Yes. Let's look at the question of screen reader choice, and obviously Technovision Systems is a strong promoter of Window Bridge. Do you retail other screen readers if people specifically ask for them, or are you quite steadfast about the fact that you believe this one is the best product and that's what you will sell?
The answer is no, we don't sell any other screen reader. The reason is not that we believe that Window Bridge is the best, although we know it's the best, but it's not for that reason. It is that I believe that we can only support one product like that well. If I was supplying 2 or 3 screen reading products, I wouldn't know which one I was dealing with when somebody rang up and asked a problem. I'd start getting confused, and I wouldn't know that the product as well as I would like. This industry is not large, and we can't afford, in our company anyway, to have specialists in 2 or 3 different screen readers. So therefore, as with many of the products, we've settled on one product of its type, the one that we are most comfortable with, that our users are comfortable with, and we've specialized in it.
Probably because of marketing, but also obviously because many people are very happy with its feature set. A product like JFW has an extraordinarily high profile and is demanded by many people. You don't ever feel that you might have backed the wrong horse?
No, I don't necessarily believe that it's always a good thing to be with the market leader. The market leader is there because he has a good product. He's very heavily marketed it, and that's pretty obvious in what goes on in that area. But with the slightly smaller companies, I believe they have to try harder, because they've got this guy up at the top who's walking all over them, and they've got to produce a better product, because if they don't produce a better product, they'll be out of business tomorrow.
What sold you on Window Bridge in particular, and what continues to give you confidence in it?
I think the kind of backup support that I as a dealer get from CentreVoice is second to none. They're absolutely, you know, committed. If I pick up the phone and call them, and I quite often do, if I happen to be out on site and I have a problem on a particular site, and, you know, everybody does, and occasionally I do go out to sort a window bridge problem out. If I use my cell phone and call them up, all I've got to say is, George here, I'm on my cell phone, I'm with a client, I've got a problem. And that's it. I get immediate, you know, I get immediate response, immediate help, because they know that I don't call them up on a whim. I have a problem. I'm calling on a cell phone which is horrendously expensive. Therefore, they will give me 110% support right down the line. We've also, they know us a little better, that we are a kind of company who, for example, we, just to give you a practical example, we had somebody who had a caps lock problem. It wasn't muting when he had the caps lock on. Now, we couldn't understand this because it wasn't happening with anything else. We finally tracked it down to the fact that the manufacturer of the speech synthesizer board that was in the PC had made an undocumented change. And when the board saw a capital letter coming down the line, it was doing a pitch change, but the window bridge was also doing a pitch change. So the board saw two sudden pitch changes, went into a sort of frozen animated state, and wouldn't mute the character that had previously been typed. Now, we put a lot of work into that ourselves to determine exactly how to reproduce that fault, and took that information back to CentreVoice, and they said, Struth, you're right, we know exactly what you mean, and we're able to fix it. Now, that was all done, believe it or not, in the space of, I would say, 4 hours. And when I'd left the client, I was driving back up the motorway, got a call from CentreVoice, we found it, we know what the problem is, we fixed it, and it'll be out in the next revision. That's just one instance of many that we've had with CentreVoice, and that's why I'm 100% behind them as much as they are behind me.
It's interesting that they continue to be, and we'll obviously see if we can get David on the program at some point, but it's interesting that they continue to lead the way. They were the very first Windows screen reader, and they still tend to be out there with new operating systems and new initiatives, don't they?
That's right. I mean, at the American conventions and at Site Village in England this year, Window Bridge was actually demonstrated using Windows 2000. Many are claiming to have products for it, but CentreVoice were actually demonstrating it. And I have a system here in my office with Windows 2000 on it, and we're putting various alpha test programs through it to check various things, and I'm running software that they're not running, and various other beta testers will be testing equally varied software as the development cycle progresses.
Is active accessibility a fizzer, or is it going to continue to grow in terms of its stability and take-up from within Microsoft and other vendors?
Well, what I've seen used and been involved in, again, with the beta testing schemes for active accessibility, is that active accessibility, in my view anyway, is a very, very valuable product to link in with. It does require, and I think this is where the software industry, in a sense, dislike it, because it does impose disciplines onto programmers that programmers have hitherto not had to adhere to. So there must be certain things done, certain editing done within the program for active accessibility to be able to pick up things like the names of controls and so on and so forth. Now, the beauty of all that is that if a program itself is well written, taking into account active accessibility components, the screen reader can work extremely easily with that program. And the user has huge amounts of control in terms of what feedback he wants. You know, if he wants to hear that something is a tab control or it is a radio button and what the description is, he can decide, yeah, I want to know what the element is and I want the description of the element. Whereas in some applications that he's extremely familiar with, he may not want to have that extra feedback, so he can switch it off.
See, a cynic might say that active accessibility is a means for Microsoft to fix many of the rules that they themselves have broken. And I guess Microsoft Office is an example of this, where there are so many unorthodox, wacky controls and dialog boxes and things because they were there in the first place. And active accessibility is simply correcting for that. Oughtn't we to be simply advocating for adherence to standard Windows practices? I take a program like Eudora, which doesn't have active accessibility but is incredibly popular with blind people. Isn't that an example of what can be done without it?
Yes, but I think if you look at... Eudora has become a popular program, admittedly, but I think if you look at the configuration files that different screen readers have provided for Eudora, you'll realize that Eudora is just as non-standard in many of its controls as many other products. There are remarkable things like the bullet icon that tells you whether a message has been read or unread, this kind of thing. Most of the screen readers have actually had to write a particular module to identify that and determine what it is. But going back to the Microsoft situation, yes, you know, Microsoft will admit that they've used a lot of non-standard practices and still do. But the fact is that the active accessibility team has doubled in size and is now actually having more influence on what goes on in the rest of Microsoft software development. And those divisions, if you like, are actually sitting up and taking note. Because we do tend to think, in terms of active accessibility, as purely a facility for the blind. It's not. There are 10 times as many disabled people as there are blind people with other kinds of problems who rely on active accessibility to give them better control over the software they're running.
When do you think we'll start seeing this better relationship between divisions of Microsoft and active accessibility actually manifesting itself in products? For instance, there's been a lot of talk recently about the Microsoft Dictionary's accessibility. We continue to have problems with programs like Encarta and things. I mean, when do you think we'll see some results out of all of this?
I think we're beginning to see them starting to wear down, and I think this is perhaps one of these situations where Microsoft, being such a large company, you have individuals and personality problems within divisions where somebody says, well, look, you know, it's been running fine, it's been making great sales, you know, why should I make changes for 5 or 10% of the population that perhaps can't use it? Now, people like that are gradually being replaced within Microsoft and are having to change their overall attitude in terms of accessibility generally. And therefore, I think we'll see fairly significant changes occurring over the next 3 or 4 years. It's not something that's going to happen overnight, and I don't think we can expect it to happen overnight. But it will happen. And people, you know, organizations like yours, mine, developers of software, specialist software, major charities like RNIB, etc., have all got to keep chipping away at the old block and making the points that this stuff has to be accessible, and it isn't difficult or costly to make it accessible. This is the whole point. If you're planning something from day one, incorporating active accessibility is not a difficult exercise.
Yeah, it's interesting that for some time Microsoft appears to have stopped communicating with the blind community through email lists, and for a while there were certain people from Microsoft who had the PR attraction of a road accident, to be quite frank, who probably made things worse. But since then, there really hasn't been a lot heard from Microsoft in blindness-related forums, and I wonder whether, you know, the no-news phenomenon is causing nervousness.
I wouldn't assume that because Microsoft isn't seen as a presence on these boards or these lists, that they aren't aware of what's going on. I think, unfortunately, the problem was, I recall an instance of one particular individual who would at least go out to defend Microsoft or to try and explain things. And the poor guy ended up absolutely being a punchbag for anybody that had a grievance against Microsoft. So much so that he finally said, look, you know, I'm just going to leave this lot. I'll listen to you all, but I'm not going to contribute anymore. And I could quite understand his feelings in that area.
Yes, although, to be fair, a lot of it was self-inflicted through the nature of the responses that were often given, but it was a difficult time then. We just have, in particular, active accessibility wasn't present in Internet Explorer 4. That was a major blue.
That was, as far as I know, having talked to some of the active accessibility team, that was a major embarrassment. It was a major marketing and political blunder on Microsoft's part, which I don't think will ever happen again. I believe that the executive who made this decision to release it ahead of time had some serious explaining to do. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but I know that it caused considerable embarrassment all round.
Yes, what do you think will happen in terms of screen reader development from Microsoft? Obviously, as a Windows 2000 preliminary user, you will have seen the narrator function that we've heard so much about.
The which function?
The narrator, apparently.
Oh, narrator, sorry.
And I just wondered whether you think that will ever evolve into a fully-fledged screen reader from Microsoft.
I very much doubt it. Narrator is simply there as a means of providing some spoken help while the system is booting up. In no way is it a screen reader. The technology that's used is completely different from the technology used for a full-blown screen reader. There is no off-screen model involved in the sense that screen readers use them. And it is purely there because at the NT format requires certain things to happen before a screen reader can kick in and start working.
Would it be advantageous for blind people, do you think, if Microsoft were to develop a screen reader?
Well, it would certainly kill any competition in the industry, or would be in severe danger of doing that. So therefore you would be probably in a situation where one company provided one screen reader, and it wouldn't be worth anybody else doing anything in addition, because this industry is not like the web browsing industry where you've got this competition between Netscape and Explorer. Netscape as a company have other things which keep them going, that provide income for the company, even though Netscape is given away free. If the same sort of thing applied to the screen reader companies, what would the screen reader companies do as an alternative? They'd just go to the wall, because they're not big enough.
As a vendor, you would probably experience recommendations from various assessors who would make recommendations as to equipment that blind people need. In the UK, is there an issue regarding the quality of those assessments and recommendations? Because often you hear on email lists from around the world people suggesting that the recommendations that come from such people often relate more to the products that they're familiar with rather than the particular product to best match the requirements of the blind person.
That particular topic is, shall we say, somewhat emotive over here at the moment, because there are talks underway at the moment to provide accreditation schemes both for trainers and for assessors. Now, it has been recognized that the quality of both assessment and training in this country has been at best very good, and at worst absolutely deplorable. And therefore, some form of standards have to be laid down. Now, I think it's quite an exciting time over here in the UK, because plans are being made at the moment, certainly to provide accreditation standards for trainers. Now, personally speaking, I feel quite strongly about this, that some form of standards have to be set and adhered to, so that the client gets the most and the best out of the money that he's paying for a day's training. And we have all too many instances where, in fact, people who are, shall we say, qualified trainers, who may even hold a teaching diploma and are qualified teachers, are going out doing training on the basis of having read the manual for the product 2 or 3 days beforehand. They don't know that product inside out. They don't know any of the technical aspects of it. They may not even know that the product has got any form of copy protection or can or cannot run under certain circumstances. And the net result is that there are many instances where systems are being virtually totally screwed up as a result.
So how do you measure that kind of competency? If you're making a judgment call, you're a government bureaucrat somewhere making a judgment call as to whether that person should be accredited as an assessor, how do you actually measure whether somebody's got what it takes or not?
Well, that's not really a subject which I have any expertise or control over. I think this is a subject which the people in places like the Department of Further Education and Employment and in the education sector generally are best able to judge.
Mm.
And just because somebody knows a product inside out, equally so, does not mean to say that he's going to be good at training in that product.
Yes, imparting the knowledge is quite different from having it, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mm. And it's getting a combination of somebody who has the ability to impart knowledge and also has the expertise and the skill in the individual product. And it doesn't just end at adaptive technology, as I've been trying to point out to these groups. If somebody's going along to train somebody in a, they've called up and they said, well, I want some window bridge training, let's say. What usually happens is that an individual will go along, and it's actually training in an application that is required, not just training in the screen reader. So you'll be faced with training in something like Word for Windows, because that's what the person wants to use, or training in Internet Explorer, because they particularly want to do web browsing, etc. Therefore, you require that additional knowledge of the application as opposed to the adaptive equipment. And that is very often more important, and I've found situations where people go along to train somebody in, say, Word for Windows in an employment situation, and the trainer himself doesn't even know how to set up a template in Word for Windows, and that's a relatively fundamental thing that can make life easier and therefore can make that employee more productive. So therefore, there are other areas that are essential. For example, the trainer discussing with the employer, what does the employer expect to have out of this training? What does he expect that employee to be able to do? What is reasonable? What is practical? So there are a whole group of areas that need to be looked at in terms of preparing this accreditation scheme and how the whole thing's going to operate.
Yeah, and if it was a sighted person being given that training, generally it would be expected that the trainer would have something like Microsoft Office User Specialist certification of some degree, or something that was quite measurable on a qualifications framework or something like that.
That's right.
It seems to me that
if I was going to use or have training done here in my office on Microsoft Office, I would actually be looking for a trainer who does carry a Microsoft certification.
And yet blind people are expected worldwide, really, to settle for less, aren't they?
Well, they're not expected to settle for less. It's what they demand. Now, this is where the accreditation scheme is trying to, make people aware of this, that yes, you can have somebody who's an extremely good trainer, but is he accredited in training on that particular product? Does he carry a Microsoft training certification?
What about blind people getting these qualifications? Because obviously there is a lot of skepticism. Many employers still don't know that blind people can use a computer at all. Do you know of any blind people who've successfully taken Microsoft Office user specialist qualifications?
There are a number of people I know who have actually taken those qualifications. It has been a bit of a battle. It has been a struggle because bear in mind that in many instances, you're not actually dealing with Microsoft themselves. You are dealing with an agent of Microsoft who in turn is certified to train people how to train. And there are also two areas or two different divisions or two sections, if you like. You're talking about one is a person who is certified to train you in terms of you using the system. And then there is another form of certification, which is to train people who are ultimately going to train others. And this is where one has to be a little careful in determining what's what. And I know a lot of people who have been trained and who have passed, you know, a Microsoft or an Access course in how to use it, but that doesn't mean to say that they've passed a course in how to teach others how to use it.
Just out of interest, what's the accessibility like of the software that puts you through these Microsoft exams?
Well, it's the application software, isn't it?
Right. So this,
you know, if you're doing a course in Word for Windows, it's Word for Windows that you are working with and having to prove that you can use.
There are questions, etc., or tasks that pop up on the screen, though, aren't there?
Yes, there obviously are. That's up to you and the company in terms of the screen reader that you choose to use to do that examination with.
Right. So it's doable, though?
It's doable, yes.
Mm. Look at the future now for us as we come to the end of this really fascinating chat. What do you think things will be like in, say, 2 or 3 years' time? Are you filled with a sense of optimism for the near future?
I think the industry is changing very dramatically at the moment. There are various things that have been happening that we see more publicly, where the Braille division of one company has been sold off to another company. I think we're likely to see both mergers and perhaps companies going out of business altogether, and the industry going under a kind of metamorphosis as technology develops, because there are at the moment some quite tasty new developments coming along that may or may not have an overall effect. I mean, it's like anything that's been developed. Some things will take off and go like an express train, and other things will just fall flat on their face.
So are we going to see a bit of turmoil in terms of structures and companies over the next couple of years?
I think there's going to be an element of that. And, of course, at the moment, there's, as always, but I think it's more intense at the moment, a greater degree of competition. What I believe that we have to do is to make the end user more aware of what his rights should be, that he can demand, you know, better standards of training, better standards of assessment, and even better products.
That's marvellous. I appreciate you giving up some time to talk to us on Blindline, and I hope we can do this again sometime.
It's been a pleasure, Jonathan. It's been a pleasure.